like me, you have heard statements such as this. Well, it was just by an act of providence that I met my spouse. Or it was just by God's providence that I relocated to this area. Or God providentially put me in this situation where I got this good job. I found that Christians freely make statements giving credit to God for good things. And that is a good thing. We know from the book of James that every good gift is from God. Everything that we enjoy is from Him. However, when we start assigning providence to different things, we are playing a very dangerous sport. And the reason for that is, we are sailing in God's waters. We're saying that through our judgment, we're deducing that God has acted in this way to make this result happen. And so as we think about providence in that sense, we must be very careful about how we talk about it. So this evening, how do we deal with the topic of providence? Well, 3 or 4 months ago when Tony called me and he gave me 2 or 3 topics and I chose this one, I told him then, I said, what looks good now when I start preparing this may not look so good, may not look so easy, and I stand by that, but it's been a very good study for me. And forcing oneself to think about these things, to put belief alongside the Bible, is very, very helpful. And I hope this evening that while we're certainly not going to be able to answer every question on providence, we can at least see how God would like for us to view His interaction within our lives. So, this is going to center around Joseph. But we're going to wait on him a little while. We're going to talk about him in a little bit later on in the context of this whole topic. But what I'd like for us to do tonight is to actually begin with looking at the word providence itself. This is a word that's very important for us to understand since obviously it's the topic of our lesson. Now, what's the best thing to do? Well, the best thing to do to begin with is to look at where the word is used in the Bible. Now, depending on your translation, it may not be in there at all. If you go to your concordance and you look for the word providence, you may find no entry there. But there are a couple of occasions where the root word that could easily be translated providence is found. So let's take a look at those. One of those we find in a fairly unusual situation. The Apostle Paul is making his defense and he's appearing and we find this being said. When he had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, since through you we enjoy much peace, and since by your foresight, most excellent Felix, reforms are being made for this nation. So here the word foresight could easily be translated providence. It would be the same root. And thus, what's happening here, Felix is being praised for his providence, for his foresight. The other place we find the Apostle Paul using this as he writes the Romans in chapter 13. He says, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision, again, same root as the word providence, for the flesh to gratify its desires. Now, there's something else these two passages have in common besides only being the places where the word providence could be found. What they both have in common is that neither is talking about God. The word is not associated with God in any situation here. In fact, in the first one, in the book of Acts 24, it's talking about Felix's oversight. How that he has come up with this great plan, and you can see a little buttering up in this language too, that through him all of these great things have happened. In the second passage, in Romans 13, what we're finding there is a command to us about providence, where we're being told, you know, give no foreknowledge, give no providence, give no provision for the flesh. And the idea that's being presented there is, don't do anything where your end result is going to be gratification of the flesh. We might think about that with someone who knows it's wrong to look at online pornography. But he's sitting there at his computer and he says, oh, I'm going to type in these words and then feign shock when something bad comes up, knowing fully that the search was going to lead him to the object of that fleshly desire. Paul says, don't allow that to happen. Don't give it any foresight. All right, so let's take that now and let's look at how that word actually makes its way into the English language. We begin with the language of the New Testament. I am not a Greek scholar by any means, so I'm depending on someone else's knowledge here. But I think it's pretty obvious that when the word providence or the word foreknew or a variation of that is used in the New Testament, it means to foresee, to attend to. So you could use that in relation to a man like Felix. He was overseeing a plan. He was attending to something in order to produce a very good consequence from it. Now, the Greek will then translate into the Latin language as the Romans begin to use this word. They take it with the exact same meaning, yet they begin to add a little bit to it. And in Latin, when it comes to the Romans, they begin talking about this in terms of the foreknowledge or the foresight or the planning of the gods in their lives. I tried to do a little research on this. I kept having some dead ends on it, but the best I can tell, the Romans actually created a goddess by the name of Providentia. And it wasn't so much that they believed in her, but yet invented her as a concept of how the gods treated them. So when they talked about all of these good things that the Roman gods were doing for them, all of these ideas were summed up in this belief of Providentia. Well, that's going to have a major impact on how we use the word providence as well. So, as the word continues on, it comes to the English language, and the first time that we find the word providence being used in our language is actually around the 14th century, and it retains that old Greek meaning, the idea of foreseeing, yet it's also tinged with the Roman idea, so that as people talked about providence, the foreseeing of something, it was almost always associated with God. But let's save that for just a minute. Let's talk about what the word in its literalness actually means. We could think about it somewhat like planning a trip. If you've taken a vacation this summer or you're planning on taking one, you start at point A, and the destination you're hoping to reach is point B. And so what you do, if you're old school, you take out your atlas and you look at all the roads. If you're kind of modern, you go to the Google Maps or whatever and you type in the 2 points and you look at the different ways that you can get from this point to this point. That's providence. Okay? What you're doing is you're doing an overview looking how you can reach your destination. Now, in a little more keeping with the word, we might think if we had a building project going on, who might we hire to make sure that it gets done in the right way? We might hire a foreman for that. What does the foreman do? He's got the whole project in view. He's looking at it and he's saying, here's the plan, here's what I want to happen, and here is how we get to that end result. And if neither of those examples are satisfactory for you, let's think about the golf course. When you go to the golf course and you see a golf ball flying towards you, hopefully you've already heard the golfer yell, four. Well, why would he do that? Well, if I understand correctly, that's actually a shortened version of an old term in Scotland that originated as four caddy. And back in the early days of golf, when the golf balls were so expensive, they didn't want to lose any of them. So if the ball was going to be hit a long distance, the golfer would yell to his caddy, you watch that ball. You look and see where it's going, and when it lands, you start working out your plan to get there and retrieve that ball from me. All of those are giving us the concept of what this word means in the English language. Now, let's take it a step further. When we bring it to the 21st century, the word itself, I think, has somewhat taken on a different meaning. What I'm going to tell you now is purely anecdotal. If you were to go to a dictionary, you would find a standard definition such as foreseeing or foreknowledge. But when I hear that word used or I read that word being used, it is almost always in the 21st century used for a specific instance in time. I went to this party, and by the providence of God, I met my wife. I went to this job interview, and by the providence of God, I received this job that's been so good for me. So we've taken it not out of the context of religion, but we've almost made it more of a laser focus on particular ideas. And that's going to be important for us as we get a little bit further in our lesson this evening. So with all of that as a rather lengthy introduction, let's think now about the life of Joseph. I trust that by this point in your summer series, you have heard the story of Joseph plenty of times so that I don't have to go over all the details. So I'm going to go on that presupposition. And we're going to go to the end of Joseph's life, or not the end of his life, but the end of the time that we're primarily reading about within the Scripture. And I want us to note what Joseph had to say when he's reunited with his brothers. When they come to Egypt, and you'll recall how they made that journey there, and Joseph has revealed his identity to them, notice what Joseph has to say in chapter 45. We're going to begin in verse 3. Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. So Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near to me, please." And when they came near, he said to them, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and ruler over all the land of Egypt." Now let me ask you this question. Did Joseph believe in the providence of God? The answer to that is absolutely yes. In this one conversation, three times he says, "God sent me here. God has put me in this location." In fact, at the last one, he says, "Wasn't you who did this? It was God who put me in this location." And as Joseph looks back over his life and he thinks about, "Well, I'm this country boy and I've ended up in the palace of Pharaoh," he understood that there was a reason for that. That he was here to keep that remnant of his family alive. Now, did he understand all the implications of that? I doubt it, seriously. But he knew that his family would not live if it had not been for the plan of God. Let's look at one other statement Joseph makes. After the death of Jacob, the brothers are again terrified that Joseph is going to kill them. They have a guilty conscience. And this particular speech didn't soothe that any. They're still worried. They think that once Jacob is dead, Joseph is going to wreak havoc on them. Listen again to what Joseph tells them. So he brings his brothers close once again, chapter 50 this time, verses 19 and 20. Joseph said to them, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me." Let's stop right there for a minute. Joseph does not let his brothers off the hook. He doesn't say, "Well, that's okay, everything's all right, I know you didn't mean anything bad." Oh no. He says, "You meant to do evil to me. You meant to kill me." But now look at the full statement. "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today." So, four times, in these speeches to the brothers, we've got Joseph saying, "All of this is the plan of God. I recognize it as His foreknowledge, His providence." And Joseph said, "It's because of all of this that you are alive, because God has put me here to make that happen." Now, let's ask something a little tougher. How many events in the life of Joseph were direct acts of God's providence? So let's think about this for just a few minutes. Because really here, we start getting into some of the heady questions about providence. Did God make those brothers have an evil heart so that Joseph would end up in the land of Egypt? Is that how it worked? Could not God have just as easily said, Joseph, go to Egypt? Do we have precedents for that? We most certainly do. Remember who Joseph's great-grandfather was. Abraham. What did God say? Abraham, go to the land I'm going to show you. You follow me. Could God have done that with Joseph? For certain He could have done that. So did God cause Potiphar's wife to sexually harass Joseph? Did God put him in this household so that this woman would make these overtures toward him and he would get in trouble for that? Could God not have just as easily thumped Mrs. Potiphar right out of the way, this wicked woman causing problems for his servant? He certainly did it with Jezebel, didn't he? Here she was, pushed out of a window, run over by a chariot, eaten by the dogs. God can get rid of wicked people when He wants to. Couldn't He have just as easily made it where Potiphar would go to Pharaoh and laud the praises of Joseph and talk about this? Could God not have jogged the memory of that servant who promised to remember Joseph but forgot? Could God not have somehow made him remember? Well, the answer to these is certainly yes. And so, let me give you the definitive answer for this. How many events in Joseph's life were direct acts of God's providence? I have no idea. I have no clue. Which ones God said, okay, I am going to make this happen, and which ones happened incidentally. Yet, for certain, we can say this, that although we cannot pinpoint every answer we might like, did God have a plan? Yes. Did Joseph know that God had a plan? Yes. Did God do whatever it took to make that plan come into effect? And the answer to that is absolutely yes. You have studied a lot about Joseph thus far. But one thing that stands out to me in this long section that we have on this man, so much dedicated within the Bible to him, God does not put us inside Joseph's head very often. Now, a couple occasions He does. But primarily, God is showing us the journey that He's making. He doesn't tell us what He's thinking in Potiphar's household. He doesn't tell us what He's thinking in the prison. Does He think God's forgotten? He doesn't do all of that. And neither does He do that toward the end of the story. He doesn't say anything about Joseph reflecting on all of these events, and he knew that because he was in Potiphar's household, all these things happened. Simply what Joseph says is, God had a plan, I was a part of that plan, and thus God made it work. So, where are we then as we think about Joseph and providence? Well, while we may not be able to answer the question as fully as we like, one thing we do know, God can fulfill a plan. But there's something else I want us to think about as well. Something else we learn about this plan is that Joseph's righteousness was a major, major part of the journey. Was Joseph the only man walking the face of the earth that God could have sent to Egypt to save His people? Absolutely not. There is no one save Jesus Christ who is indispensable who's ever walked the earth. God can work His plan however He so chooses, but why did He choose Joseph? Because he was a man who had a heart to serve God. He was a man who took this very long and convoluted journey to Egypt, running into all kinds of obstacles, but in every case, he trusted that God would see him through it. And when you and I think about the providence of God, that's something we've got to focus on as well in our own lives, as we'll think about as we make some more personal applications to this. Now, as we look at all of this, and as we think about Joseph and his journey, the question might come, why has God taken all of this time, all of this real estate within the book of Genesis to tell us about Joseph? What's his point? There's a good thing to do when we have questions like that. And the question that we ask is this, what did this mean for Israel? The reason I say that is because the books of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy are a history book of the early days of Israel. Here, as the people were about to land in Canaan, they were sitting on the doorsteps, and Moses is writing all of these things down, recording it for them. It was for a purpose and for a reason. There were lessons to be learned. And so, I would encourage you, wherever you're studying within the Pentateuch, to stop and to ask, what would this mean for Israel? Why would God want them to know this? So let's ask that question. And of course, the first answer that would come to mind is this. He wanted them to know their history. He wanted them to know how they got to this situation. And so he begins, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And God created the first man. And God placed man in the garden. And man sinned. And he takes us through this story. He's taking his people through this story. And he shows them, first of all, their creation. He shows them then how they landed in the land of Canaan. And then he shows them how they were removed to Egypt. Now, why would they need to know all of that? They would need to know all of that because God had made another promise to them. He had said, I want to get you back to that land. I'm going to take you to the land of Canaan, and you're not going to be strangers in it. You're going to be the rulers in it. I'm going to give you that land. So how could they trust God? They could read their history book. What had God spent all of those early pages of Genesis doing? It was showing that He was in control. And if He wanted somebody to get from point A to point B, He could make sure it happened. Now, let me give you this little speculation on my part. Does the story of Joseph not illustrate that? That here is one man, and God has a plan for him, and it means getting him from the household of Jacob into the courts of Pharaoh. That sounds almost impossible. Some backwoods little country boy who's hated by his irascible brothers, and God is going to get him into the palace of Pharaoh. It happened, though, didn't it? And if anybody thought that these ragtag Israelites could take the land of Canaan, God was saying, well, of course they can. Not because of their power, but because of who I am. Well, let's dig a little deeper into that. Not only does it show them God can accomplish His plan, but let's look at some of the occasions within the life of Joseph that taught them lessons. Would the people of Canaan also be the adulteress, kind of like Potiphar's wife? Would the people of God be tempted in a similar fashion to Joseph to be unfaithful? Well, absolutely they would. There were going to be all of these Canaanites, and God often would describe the sins of Israel as committing adultery against Him. In fact, much later on, the prophet Hosea would make a book out of it, wouldn't he? And so here, they could look at the life of Joseph and they could see that in the short term, it didn't bring a lot of happiness to stay faithful, but what happened in the long term? God was with them. What would happen to them in the long term if they stayed faithful? God would be with them. Would there also be times within the life of the Israelites that it would appear that God had forgotten them? The answer to that is yes. Kind of as Joseph sitting in that dark prison cell, though it's not stated, I can hardly imagine that Joseph didn't have occasions where he wondered where God was. Why has God left me here? Why am I here? Would there be times when Israel would feel that way? Absolutely. That'll especially be the case much later in their history, when the faithful are sitting in these foreign lands. When you've got faithful people who are sitting in these Babylonian lands, in fact, some of the Psalms cry out, God, have You forgotten us? Have You deserted us? But yet, what could they do? They could look to the life of Joseph, and within their history book, God had showed them, though things may be dark at times, if I have a plan, that plan is going to be accomplished. So the people of Israel had much to learn, not only about how they made it to Egypt, but also how God could deliver them into that land of promise and to make them His people. Well, let's take this a little more personally. Let's note something as we think about God's plan for them. As we have noted, nothing is going to stop that plan except for one thing. There's only one thing that'll thwart this plan. And that would be the unrighteousness of His people. And that's a lesson you and I need to understand. That God is saying, I'm going to do something here, but if you do not follow Me, I'll change the plan. If you do not obey Me, what could they learn from Joseph? Joseph was faithful every step of the way. There is not a time that we're told of in that journey from the pit to the palace where it says Joseph sinned against God and had to beg His forgiveness. Every instance is met with a rock solid righteousness. And what was true for Joseph was true for Israel. And what was true for Israel is certainly true for us. So then let's ask ourselves a question. Does God have an end point for us? He intended to get Joseph into Pharaoh's palace. He intended to get Israel into the land of Canaan. Does He have an end point? Does He have a plan for us? The answer to that is absolutely yes. Do we know what that plan is? We most certainly do. As the Apostle Paul wrote to the Romans, he said this to them, "And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good for those who are called according to His purpose." What God is saying to us in that passage is, I've got a plan for you. I've got good in mind for you, stored up for you. So how is God going to accomplish that plan? How through His providence is He going to make that happen? Let's drop this verse in its context and we'll see that. So here we are. God is saying, I'm going to do good for those who love Me. All things are going to work together for good. How is that going to be accomplished? It's going to be accomplished, obviously, by the help of God Himself. As we look here in this passage written to the Romans, chapter 8, listen to what he says when the apostle writes, "Likewise, the Spirit helps us in our weakness." You ever felt like just giving up? Life is getting so hard, you just want to give up? This is a good passage to come to. God says, there is help for you. Situations arise in our lives, we have no idea how we need to handle them, much less do we know what we need to pray about for. What does God say? "For we do not know what to pray for as we ought, but the Spirit Himself intercedes for us with groanings too deep for words. And He who searches hearts knows what is the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for the saints according to the will of God." And what? "And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good." Isn't that amazing? That when you and I are at this point in our lives and we feel like we're just at the end of our rope and we feel like maybe God's not paying much attention to us and we don't know what to pray for, the Spirit comes to our rescue. He intercedes for us. And God says, "I know the mind of the Spirit. Thus I know what you need." God helps. And what else does God do? God conforms us. He says, "For those whom He foreknew, He also predestined to be conformed to the image of His Son in order that He might be the firstborn among many brothers." That idea of conformity should be just as faith building. What that means is that if I love God and I'm willing to trust God, God is going to take me like a lump of clay and He's going to mold me into the shape of His Son. And what that means for me is this. I'll know how to act. I'll know what to do because I can see what the Son did. And when I have the same attitude as the Son, as one of the sons of God, I'll know how to behave myself. This is a powerful passage. Because here we have Father, Son, and Spirit all declared to be on our side, working for us. God in His fullness is for us. And that means God is going to supply every need that we have. Listen to what He says here as we think about this. He says, "Those whom He predestined, He also called. And those whom He called, He also justified. And those whom He justified, He also glorified." God calls the faithful. God justifies the faithful. God, this is the most amazing part, I think, of the verse, glorifies. That's a word reserved for God. But yet here God says, I'm going to glorify you. Why? Because I'm remaking you in the image of my Son. I'm making you a glorified being. And nothing will stand in the way of God in doing this. So as Paul brings this particular part of the chapter to a head, he says, what then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? God has a plan. God has a plan. And God is going to make that plan happen, and ain't nobody going to stand in His way. But let's tie this back into our theme. What does this then mean concerning my attitude about His providence? What does this mean that I need to know? Well, first of all, I need to know that there are times that God will act overtly in my life. There will be times when God will change the direction of what's happening. I'm assured of that. Because as Paul wrote to the Corinthians, listen to what he told them. He said, no temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and He will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. That's an overt act. God is saying, you will never find yourself in a situation that you can't overcome. And when you get into difficult situations, listen to what He says. But with the temptation, He will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. God says to us, I'm watching. And you are not going to get into a mess that you can't get out of. But there will be times of temptation. But here's the promise. There's always an exit sign. May not be terribly obvious to us at first. May not be something that we see immediately. But God says, I promise, there will always be a way of escape. Those are overt acts. Those are things that God is doing directly in our lives. But let me hastily add this. Not every action is overtly planned by God. I started to entitle this lesson, How to Study Providence Without Becoming a Calvinist. I see so easily how someone gets off in that Calvinistic mindset that God has already decided who's going to be saved, and He has made this inconcrete path for the saved, and there is no veering one way or the other from it. But we know that's not right. To accept that is to totally deny free will. To accept that is to say that the writer of Ecclesiastes had no idea what he was talking about. When he says this, again I saw that under the sun, the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge, but time and chance happen to all. There are going to be times in our lives that just plain old dumb luck is going to happen. And sometimes that might work to our advantage if we're the slow guy winning the race, if we're the not so bright person getting honored. And sometimes that's going to work to our disadvantage when it looks like we should be succeeding, but it appears we're failing. Not every action is overtly planned by God. And when these occasions occur, which they will on a daily basis, these are the times that my faith must shine. I want you to think about an example of this from the life of Joseph. Here he was. He was in an abandoned house with this woman who wanted to have her way. Joseph's a young man. He's got needs. Here is a woman very willing to fulfill those needs. In the short term, it would boost his career. He would have her on his side. This was a time when Joseph was being tempted. What'd God say? He said, first of all, you can overcome that. Second of all, I'm going to provide a way of escape. What was that way of escape? Well, listen to what Joseph has to say. He says to this woman, he is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except you, because you are his wife. And then this statement, how then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? Joseph says, I am in a situation here I don't want to be in. Did God put him in that situation? I highly doubt that. So here it is, time and chance, all alone. Joseph says, I'm going to be faithful. I'm going to let my faith shine regardless of what happens. And he ultimately glorifies God in that decision. So, the moral of that story is things are going to happen to us. If I fall down tonight and break my arm, I don't think that's all things working together for good. I think that's because I'm kind of klutzy. And so I fall and I break it. But what if I'm taken to the hospital and here I am, I'm waiting to get my arm set. And I start talking to the nurse. Well, you know, I was at Bible study tonight. Bible study? Really? On a Wednesday night? Yeah. And what if the nurse is converted? You see, all things work together for good. Does it mean that God has this in stone path and you and I cannot veer from it and He's got every action planned? No. What it means is He knows how to get somebody from point A to point B. And if this nurse is willing to listen, God's giving her the opportunity to get from point A to point B. And thus, whether it's an overt act of God or whether it's something that's happening simply because time and chance is present, I am looking to glorify God and I am looking to be like Joseph, to trust Him. And let me emphatically add that as we think about all of these things, God will get the faithful to heaven. That is going to happen. There is no doubt about it. And so you and I come to this topic of providence with all of its questions and all of the disagreements and theories on it. But here's one thing that we need to understand, that my understanding of His working is not important. My understanding that He is working for me is essential. How God chooses to get me to heaven is God's business. God has a plan. And like Joseph, with that plan, I must realize that my righteousness is essential. God's not going to force me to go there. God has not set my name in iron in the book of life and there is no way I can take it out of there. I can. But if I am faithful, if I am one of His people, if I have been conformed to the image of His Son, God says, all things work together for good. And that means whatever it takes, and however God needs to direct the journey, and whatever God needs to do, He is going to do for that purpose to be accomplished. And isn't that a tremendous thought? That you and I are not on this road by ourselves. That God, unlike what the deists tell us, has not wound up the earth and set it aside and left us on our own. God is with the faithful. But here's where I come in. Do I trust Him? When times look bleak, do I trust Him? When it looks like I am in a room with no exit, do I trust Him? I can assure you that I would not want to trade places with Joseph any day of the week for that journey that he was on. But yet what I do know is that I want to be like him. And I want to be the kind of person who that no matter what's going on in my life, no matter how difficult it may look, I trust in the foreknowledge of God and trust that God has a plan to get me to heaven. So this evening, if you're not a Christian, I want to tell you that. God has a plan to get you to heaven. He is going to make that happen if you're willing to start the journey. The way you do that is through baptism. Baptism alone would do nothing for you, but it's the understanding that comes with it, that here is where the grace of God will be put on full display. That when you're buried in the waters of baptism, there's nothing magic that's going to happen in those waters. But that is a testimony to your faith that you trust God and that God has said, in baptism, your sins will be washed away. That's His plan. Providentially, He has set that on course. And so this evening, if you understand that and you're ready, why delay? Why put it off? Maybe you've kind of faltered on your way. Where God has given you the promise of security, maybe you've doubted Him, and maybe you've allowed that to take you in directions you don't need to go. This evening, this congregation would be happy to accompany you to the throne room of God to pray for forgiveness. Nobody will go with you as a judge because we all have sinned and fallen short of His glory. But all of us will go as brothers and sisters in Christ to lift you up. Maybe it's just a temptation that's plaguing you. You don't have to wait for a sin to request the prayers of brethren. Maybe there's something and you just don't know the way out. Let's pray together. Let's give the Spirit that opportunity to utter to the Father the things that we need so that the Father in His glory will continue that conformity of you into His Son's image so that in that final day you can be glorified. Providence of God is an amazing thing because God is an amazing God. If you need to respond in any way to His invitation this evening, won't you come while we stand and sing together?